In the coming week, the Tokyo Summer Olympics kick off under a COVID-19 shadow. Iraq's Prime Minister visits the White House, and South Africa faces the consequences of deadly rioting. It's July 22nd, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, they're finally here. The Tokyo Summer Games, the 2020 Games, and now in 2021, the pageantry is about to come here. Some competitions have already begun, but they're taking place in front of hardly anybody. But first, can you tell us a bit more about what Japan is facing, what it's up against as it's trying to host these Summer Games?
Certainly, Bob. The Games formally open tomorrow, though as you point out, a number of Olympic events are already underway. I will note that the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team, or for our non-U.S. listeners, football team, got drubbed 3-0 yesterday by Sweden. Congrats to the Swedes. That ended the United States' 44-match unbeaten streak. That said, there's a lot of uneasiness about the Games. I think your opening question hinted at it. Again, it's not because of terrorism, something that has plagued a lot of Olympics since the horror of Munich nearly a half century ago, but because the Games themselves have been compromised by the pandemic and the fear that the Olympics as a whole could become a super spreader event for COVID-19. Especially the much more infectious Delta variant. Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga is a big booster of the Games, which were supposed to be the capstone for the long career of his predecessor, Shinzo Abe, as well as a big shot in the arm, no pun intended, for the Japanese economy and tourism. That, of course, was before the Olympics were postponed last year because of COVID. Suga went ahead with the Games despite, as he has admitted, being advised many, many times to cancel the Games. That's certainly what the Japanese public wanted him to do. Public opinion polls show that 2 out of 3 Japanese citizens wanted the Games either canceled or postponed. That sentiment is not surprising as COVID cases have surged in Tokyo recently. The capital area has been under a state of emergency since July 12, and a number of Olympic athletes and associated personnel have already tested positive for the coronavirus. Indeed, things are so touchy that Toyota, which happens to be Japan's largest company and one of the Olympics' primary corporate sponsors, has pulled all of its Olympic advertising in Japan. Presumably, the executives at Toyota don't want to be caught on the wrong side of public opinion. Now, Suga's response is that while Japan's case rate is increasing, it's still just 1/4 the level of the United States, and the death rate from COVID-19 in Japan is just 1/7 of what it is in the United States. The Japanese Prime Minister has also said that Japan is taking a number of steps, like not allowing spectators at the events and encouraging widespread mask wearing to limit transmission. Suga has also pointed out that lots of other countries are opening up. He's in particular pointing to the fact that London just hosted Wimbledon and the finals of the UEFA Euro 2020 soccer, again for non-American listeners, football tournament. And Suga argues that even if you don't get as many tourists and even if you can't put people in the stands, Japan is still going to benefit from global television coverage. Now, Suga has a lot riding on his decision. Japan has elections in October, and if public opinion polls are to be believed, the prime minister is in big trouble. His support level is hovering just around 30%. However things play out over the next couple of weeks in Tokyo, it's not likely that Japan is going to see the hoped-for economic tourist boom from the Olympics. What we do know is that the Olympics look to have produced a gusher of red ink for Japan. Initial predictions were that the Olympics would cost Japan something on the order of $7.4 billion. The official budget now is some $15 billion, and the true number may be as high as $30 billion. Now, Bob, we've discussed this in past years. This is not something new. This is a pattern we see at Olympics time and time again, leaving the big question, why do cities and countries bid on the Olympics when it's going to cost them this much money?
Well, Jim, in light of what you just laid out, it does seem to be curious how these games can proceed. And let me just start by saying I enjoy the Summer Olympics as much as anyone and have been eager in many ways for them to take place. But as the gathering gloom has been occurring this year, it feels like it's just a a lose-lose proposition. We could end up celebrating this in 2 weeks' time as an incredible feat. But as you say, at the very least, it's going to be a lot of red ink. We've had a losing streak of Summer Olympics hosts now for multiple Olympics. And even though you just had, I think the city of Brisbane, Australia, has just been selected as a 2032 Games host, I think that decision was made in part because it had existing infrastructure that would require it to build up very little to accommodate the Games. And I think there was also nobody else in the running. Fewer countries are now competing because these Games are seen as an unwieldy thing, even outside of a pandemic. But we are not outside of a pandemic, so we'll have to see what happens. I'm curious, though, Jim, whether there's something else at stake for Japan here, a bit of sort of Asian status. You had a previous Winter Games that were held in South Korea. You've got the next Winter Games held in Beijing. Is Japan sort of eager to make sure it shows it can put on a show regardless of sort of things like pandemics?
No doubt, Bob. I think that's a big part of the reason that countries and cities want to host. They want to show off. They're hoping to use the moment of the Olympics basically as public relations for their city and for their country. Obviously, in this case, Japan is going to be hard put to pull that off. Now, I was actually in Japan in February of 2020. Actually, it was my last international trip. And people then were very excited about hosting the Olympics at that point, only 6 months away. They were hoping COVID wouldn't become the pandemic it has since become, because they want to present themselves to the world and show off Japanese technology, Japanese hospitality, Japanese culture. And that has been greatly limited, even though there is going to be global television coverage. One of the things we don't know, and we won't know for another couple weeks, is to what extent the competition itself is going to be affected by COVID. We've already seen a number of athletes test positive, and some of them have dropped out. I know there's a skeet competition. One of the competitors there has pulled out of the Games. The tennis player Coco Gauff, I think that's how she pronounces her last name, has withdrawn from the Olympics. Obviously, if competitors test positive, they have to be quarantined until they can produce a negative test. So that may disrupt some of the competition in the days to come. And then there's a broader question of whether or not the Olympics is going to turn out to be a super spreader event. Now, there's no evidence so far that Wimbledon was just concluded or the UEFA Euro 2020 tournament just wrapped up turned out to be a super spreader event. But if that happens, obviously, that would take a bit of the shine, perhaps a lot of the shine off of the Tokyo Olympics 2020, or I guess 2021.
Yeah, I was going to ask whether we have learned anything from some of these other global events that have taken place. It does seem, you know, as the world collectively tries to regain its setting amid this, this surging variant, sports can be a way for people to find some solace. And we did see a Wimbledon take place in front of some fans, and the European Cup Soccer Championship. We just saw the British Open take place with very few fans in place, but it was still, as a sporting event, I think it still captured a lot of attention. So I don't think we've ever seen anything like this in terms of a Games on the scale of the Olympics. And the whole soft power aspect that you were referring to, which is, by the way, something we covered in an episode on our sister podcast, Why It Matters, last year, that soft power element, can it still succeed merely by hosting a sort of skeleton of an event if there's none of the vibe and other pageantry of an Olympic Games? Although we will see an opening parade tomorrow night.
Well, the hope is, Bob, that we're going to get a good Olympics. And as a sports fan, that's what I would like to see. Obviously, when you think back over the years, Olympics have produced just great moments. I mean, think of Nadia Comaneci scoring the first perfect 10 back at the Montreal Olympics in 1976. There was Olga Korbut, Simone Biles more recently, or Greg Louganis in the Seoul Olympics in 1988, where he won a gold medal in diving, even though in the early dives, he hit the platform on the way down and gave himself a concussion. Or Michael Phelps in 2008, breaking Mark Spitz's record by winning 8 gold medals. Again, Olympics can bring out the best competition, really memorable moments, but the 2021 Tokyo Olympics obviously are taking place in a broader context that is greatly concerning. So hopefully we will get a good Olympics. And 2 weeks from now, we were saying, gee whiz, we were worried for nothing. But Bob, let's shift gears and take things back here to the United States, where Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa El-Khadimi is set to meet with President Biden in the White House on Monday. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said that the visit will highlight, let me quote her here, the strategic partnership between the two countries and advance bilateral cooperation under a 2008 agreement that governed the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq, end quote. What do we need going into these talks at the White House, Bob?
Well, Jim, we should note at first there's been a great deal of anticipation that this is going to be a meeting that's going to center on a timetable for withdrawing the remaining estimated 2,500 U.S. troops. Now, these are troops that are primarily gathered in the north of Iraq, especially at an Iraqi airbase in Erbil. And that's where the U.S. supports operations in Syria, but also or keeps an eye on the various vestiges of where the so-called Islamic State is still active. There are, by many accounts, just small pockets that remain active. They've been, in effect, defeated in both Syria and Iraq, where they had a cross-border caliphate for a short period of time that was nonetheless alarming. And it has been supposed to be primarily a mop-up operation against the Islamic State. So these talks are going to be delving into that. I think what you haven't seen in the sort of the run-up to these talks is much talk about one of the specters that over this deployment, over this relationship, which is Iran. Iran backs several Shia militias. It has, by many accounts, quite a bit of sway over Shia groups, irregular groups, and so forth in Iraq. And some of them have mounted attacks against U.S. forces that has caused the U.S. to conduct reprisal strikes. Most recently, last month, the U.S. conducted a strike against the Iranian-backed militias known as Hezbollah and Kataib Sayyid al-Shuhada, if I got that right. And that caused a great deal of concern, especially from Prime Minister Kadhimi, who basically called it a gross violation of Iraqi sovereignty. You've had Iraqi officials concerned after the U.S. had the targeted killing of Iranian leaders who were in Baghdad airport at the beginning of last year. So I think there's going to be a great deal of like, what is the form of U.S. presence in Iraq going to take? Are we dealing with another wind down that could be as dramatic as the one in Afghanistan in terms of a complete wind down? Or are we going to talk about something that's a little more phased? I think that's the big question going on.
What do you expect Joe Biden to want from his Iraqi counterpart?
A main thing, and again, the question is how vocal they'll be about this, but really assurances that Iraq is, and Iraqi officials and Shia politicians are going to not allow themselves to be dominated by Iranian leaders, Iranian forces, you know, people who are there, who are coming from Iran, from the Revolutionary Guard, as we have seen in the past, and helping to kind of orchestrate things. There's been a great deal of activity by many reports of Iranians in Iraq, and I think that's going to be probably assurance number one. It's, again, there will be some discussion about the Islamic State. There was a pretty horrible attack in a Baghdad market earlier this week in which dozens of people were killed. So the Islamic State seems to still have some potency. But I think Iran is the big issue that will be under discussion, Jim.
What should you be looking for, Bob, that would indicate that the talks didn't go well?
Jim, let's first of all look at the first of the Biden-hosted meetings with Middle East officials. So you had Jordan's king visit just this past week. And by many accounts and by public appearances, it looked like a very cordial visit. The U.S.-Jordanian alliance was touted, and it was sort of this expression of it is back after it had been shunted to the side somewhat under the Trump administration. And so that was seen as the U.S. is ready to reassert and reestablish strong alliances in the Middle East. And by the way, the Jordanian king and Biden did talk about the situation in Iraq by many accounts as well. So I think they would want to see that cordiality, that sense of a shared mission and commitment to stability in the area. You could have, though, again, hearkening back to comments that Kadhimi made last month, there's any sort of testiness about whatever delayed timetable or the U.S. assertiveness on Iraqi territory. That's the kind of thing that I think would not sit well. But it is a sore point. This U.S. mission was supposed to be expressly about going after and eradicating the Islamic State from Iraq after the U.S. had pulled out of Iraq. And I think Iraq is trying to kind of step forward into the world, and it would like to be able to step forward with the vestiges of a sovereign state. So I think it's Prime Minister Kadhimi's messaging, I think, is going to be closely watched. And there are a number of experts in the region who think he could find the means to galvanize some Iraqi independence and not be under Iran's sway. But it's not clear, because the fact is Iran is operating in Iraq right now.
Are the Iraqis worried at all about flagging U.S. commitment to democracy in Iraq? And I ask that, Bob, because the United States is withdrawing its troops from Afghanistan. They'll all be gone within a month or so. And there has been a lot of speculation that that may have unnerved American friends and allies throughout the Middle East, that Joe Biden is intent on coming home.
That's a really good question. And it's an aspect of this trip that has not gotten that much attention at this point. That could be something that emerges from this that will be of interest. It's true. You make a good point. There does seem to be this bit of unfinished business. And frankly, this is something that President Trump was intent on doing, which is ending the forever wars that the U.S. is involved in post 9/11. So Trump rather clumsily, I guess I would say, drew down sharply U.S. forces in Syria. And then that operation now is being observed from northern Iraq in great part. He was interested in drawing down forces in Afghanistan and had signed an agreement with the Taliban. And now Biden's following through on that by September 11th. By all accounts, there'll be a drastically diminished U.S. and NATO force in Afghanistan. And And you've heard about that from the Afghan sort of civil society community and the civilian government in Afghanistan, a great deal of concern. You haven't seen as much, at least I haven't seen as much from Iraqi officials about democracy deficit, about some sort of other force sweeping into the vacuum of U.S. departure, partly because the U.S. role has been this set of forces that were primarily based in the north, that has been on an anti-ISIS mission, and then occasionally countering the Iranian elements. So I'm not sure how much the U.S. has been propping up or nation building in Iraq at this point, certainly compared to 10 years ago when it was a much bigger U.S. operation in Iraq. I think the U.S. has already effectively left that scene. However, I think there is hope that through organizations like the United Nations, for example, World Bank and so forth, the U.S. can help prop up institutions and provide some sort of a stable Iraq that has some vestiges of democracy. The U.S. still, you know, recently there were protests and there was a harsh crackdown by Iraqi authorities. The U.S. was very vocal in condemning those. So I think it does want to try to nudge Iraq towards greater democratic freedoms. But I don't think you have seen this angst and this concern that a U.S. drawdown, you know, correlates into Iraq's weakening of democracy. It is a force that is supposed to be a counter-terror force, not necessarily a force that's propping up you know, more of Iraq, as, say, the U.S. forces in Afghanistan have been.
Got it, but still something to keep an eye on.
Yeah, that's right, Jim. And it's another reminder that, you know, it's unfinished business in Iraq. But I wanted to turn to something else that has raised alarm among democracy activists. And this would be in the continent of Africa, particularly South Africa, where in the past week we had deadly protests that have broken out, allegedly spurred by the incarceration and sentencing of former South African President Jacob Zuma. At this point, more than 200 South Africans have been killed. Access to basic needs like food has become an increasing issue. You've had photos of excessive looting going on, all sorts of images that had been kind of alarming to come from South Africa, because this was one of the continent's success stories. And for all its challenges, its ongoing challenges, had been a country that had stronger rule of law aspects. So, Jim, can you give us a sense on what is the situation South Africans are facing?
Happy to, Bob. Let me flag two things. First would be the trigger that touched off the deadly protests we've witnessed. The second thing would be the kindling that enabled those protests really to get underway. The trigger was former President Jacob Zuma being jailed for contempt of court. He refused to testify before a commission that he himself had set up. He has been investigated for a number of years on charges of corruption. And the debate over Zuma gets tied up with the broader question of the state of play within the African National Congress, which is the party that dominates South African politics and has since it became a multiracial democracy back in the 1990s. Now, Zuma was forced from office in 2018, but there continues to be wrangling within the ANC over control of the party because it controls big chunks of the economy. But those intra-party differences are playing out against a broader backdrop, let's call it the kindling. And when you think about sort of South Africa, you think about the immediate challenge and the broader challenges. And the immediate challenge is that South Africa, like many other countries, has been ravaged by COVID and its consequences. South Africa is now in the middle of its third wave of COVID-19. Just 2.8% of the South African public is fully vaccinated. The economy has fallen. It contracted by something on the order of 7% last year. One-third of middle-class households have hit poverty levels during the pandemic. Unemployment tops 30%, and it's even higher among the young. But you have a lot of immediate dissatisfaction about the way things are going in South Africa. And this all takes place on top of a country that has a deeply unequal economy. We love to applaud South Africa for the miraculous political transition it has undergone from apartheid South Africa to becoming a successful multiracial democracy. But the economic inequalities that built up under apartheid rule persist. And so the success on the political front hasn't led to an equaling of economic opportunity for many South Africans. So that unhappiness persists. And this has led to lots of discussions about what is the trajectory of South Africa, a question that is important because of South Africa's importance on the continent. It's not the most populous country on the African continent. Nigeria holds that title. But South Africa is important because it is in many ways the political powerhouse of Africa. And again, there's great concern that South Africa hasn't been able to become more equal or less unequal since the move away from apartheid. Although I will note in that score that our good friend and colleague, Ambassador John Campbell, in the last couple of years wrote a book called Mourning in South Africa, Morning, M-O-R-N-I-N-G, which makes the case that for all of South Africa's economic problems, for all the divisions within the African National Congress, that what is remarkable about South Africa is that its democracy is holding. And indeed, you can take a positive spin on the violence we saw over the last week or so, and that is the fact that the rule of law is holding, that former President Zuma is being held to account. He has been jailed, and that the protests, which were strongest in his home province of KwaZulu-Natal, which is in the eastern portion of South Africa, main city being Durban, really hasn't spread to the other seven provinces in the country, in that, yes, this is a problem, but we shouldn't make too much of it.
One might imagine that in the event that he was not prosecuted or was not incarcerated, could have triggered also demonstrations perhaps in other parts of South Africa, given the sort of kindling that you just kind of laid out, Jim.
No doubt, Bob. And again, if you look at South Africa, and this is true of many other countries and not just in Africa, there are great concerns about corruption, that the people in power have access to things that ordinary people don't, but also that people in power use that power to get benefits to themselves. And South Africa has been going through a process of trying to root out that corruption. Now, I'll leave it to the experts to discuss, you know, how successful that effort has been and whether it's been done in quite the right way. But there are positive aspects about what is happening in South Africa that we shouldn't lose sight of in the midst of the violence. I think the thing to pay attention to here is whether we see these riots spread. And that, I think, would be a real danger sign for South Africa in political and economic terms.
And just to take one of the elements that you mentioned, which is the coronavirus response, I think it's again highlights the need among the sort of the global powers that are supposed to be involved in disseminating vaccines to really ramp up those efforts. I did see some report that Pfizer might be opening up a facility that produces a vaccine in South Africa. Maybe that's a way to get out of it, but that's still, it still seems to be more of a remote thing as opposed to an immediate need. And this, among many countries in Africa, are in desperate need of the effective vaccines.
You're right, Bob. Pfizer potentially opening up a plant in South Africa is not going to address the immediate context. It may have a big impact over time. And again, South Africa has a very well-developed economy and is capable of this kind of manufacturing, I believe, actually has a fairly vibrant pharmaceutical industry to begin with. In the immediate term, the Ramaphosa government have turned to providing additional economic stipends to try to address some of the economic inequality that is helping fuel these riots. But Bob, let's pivot now and discuss our audience figure of the week, which listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, Bob, our audience selected 37 smartphones hacked. What's up with that?
Well, Jim, this is a complicated and growing story, and it's arousing a lot of concern because it hits everybody where they live, which is their smartphone, where increasingly people's sense of self and identity and everything resides on these smartphones. 37 smartphones that were targeted appeared on a list of actually more than 50,000 numbers that are in concentrated in countries that are known to conduct surveillance on their citizens and that have also been the clients of a company known as NSO Group. This is a Israeli company that created the spyware known as Pegasus. It is a worldwide leader in this sort of private spyware industry. And it was a group of research organizations and a consortium of investigative journalistic teams that came up with this report. And the concerning thing is that this spyware, which is supposed to be directed at, and which NSO Group says is supposed to be directed at, you know, sort of the bad guys, the people who are conducting plots or who are, you know, stealing money from accounts and creating all sorts of other nefarious bits of hacking. It's supposed to be focused on them. And in fact, there are journalists, there are human rights activists, there are some people in government agencies who seem to have been targeted by this. There's still a lot of things that are not known about this. It does seem like the work done by the researchers is showing an abuse of the spyware and raising all sorts of concerns about how such a thing is controlled, the extent to which the Israeli government might have been helping to advance the use or the sale of the spyware to friendly governments that might not necessarily have been democratic governments. There has been a lot of pushback from the company about the way its spyware is being used. We still don't know, you know, the extent to which it was acquired by authoritarian governments, but it's getting more and more scrutiny. You're seeing huge reports. My hometown Washington Post paper is is devoting acres of newsprint to this right now and is still covering more of this. What does seem to be clear is that, I think new to a lot of people, is the extent to which this Pegasus spyware can be pervasive. It can be installed remotely without a targeted phone ever knowing or ever opening a document or a website link. Apparently, there are ways you can detect it if you kind of poke around. And some of the research agencies, including Amnesty International, provide some sort of information on how you can figure out whether you've been targeted by Pegasus. But to those who are directing the spyware, they have access to everything. They have access to text messages, photos, emails, videos, contact lists. They can even activate recording to record phone calls. They can turn on a phone's microphone. They can turn on cameras and so forth, according to Washington Post and other media agencies that are part of the consortium reporting on this. So it's just our figure of the week this week, Jim, has raised all sorts of concerns about the extent to which spyware can infiltrate all sorts of people's, whether private citizens or governments, most private accounts.
Just to be clear, Bob, this spyware, this Pegasus spyware, is not something that is accessible to the ordinary citizen. You can't go on a website and download it yourself. This is something that's controlled by NSO and presumably regulated by the Israeli government.
That's correct. It is apparently, according to the reports I've seen, shedding a spotlight on how little regulated, though, this spyware is at this point. It is, you're right, it is not supposed to be something that's widely available. And again, I think as we get more revelations from what countries were involved in directing its use, we might get a little bit more sense of the path of how it was enabled. But at this point, we don't believe it's something widely available. Now, I should mention that the list of the 50,000 phone numbers that were reported by this consortium, which is, by the way, like 17 news organizations. The 50,000 phone numbers include the French president, Emmanuel Macron, South African president, Ramaphosa, you just talked about, some former prime ministers and current ones, Pakistan's Imran Khan, and King Mohammed VI of Morocco also on the list. So again, we're going to have to see how this plays out, Jim, but it's raising a lot of concern about just sort of what are the guide rails for use of spyware? Will there be some renewed effort by international organizations or groups of countries to try to get this under control?
Two things we should note here, Bob, for completeness of the discussion. One is that obviously the United States intelligence community has been engaged in listening in on spying and surveilling other heads of state, including heads of friendly countries, most famously with the Edward Snowden leak, right. The NSA, National Security Agency, listening in on German Chancellor Angela Merkel's cell phone. But also, when you get beyond this particular issue involving NSO, the release of the findings of the Pegasus Project is coming at the same time that the U.S. Justice Department is grappling with what it has been doing to surveil or get access to the records of U.S. journalists. Now, I will note, different technique. It's not using software. It is using theoretically legal means to investigate or gain access to what journalists have. But it does touch on this broader issue of what governments can and are trying to learn about what it is that journalists in particular are doing.
It's a really good point. And it also raises the questions, is there, given the fact that this, the sort of cross purposes it's going to be used for both, you know, enemies of countries or their friends and journalists, but also members of government, members of corporations, is there enough concern that, you know, authoritarian countries, let's say Russia and China, we find common cause with EU countries and the United States to set up some rules of the road for what could be allowed, understanding that they all have their own government-run efforts to use for surveillance and so forth. I think the center on press freedom, you're gonna hit, you know, a logjam right there, because Russia and China are not interested in press operating freely, certainly on their territory, but anywhere that in which they could be digging around and reporting things that they don't want reported. So it's sort of creates a new front of concern and friction involving press freedom.
And I'll just note that Attorney General Merrick Garland has greatly narrowed what it is that the Justice Department can do legally to track what it is that journalists have done when they're concerned about classified information being leaked to journalists and things like that.
I should just add, Jim, that the NSO has been responding to questions about this and has said, you know, it knows that software can be misused, but that it takes efforts to run what they call a human rights review process. And even just in the past year has cut off a couple of customers, has not named, but a couple of customers that it was concerned about because of their record of human rights abuses. And that came out in a June report that the company released on its own. Again, we don't know what else might be going on with the dissemination of this. It's going to get a huge amount of more scrutiny.
I expect we're going to be learning a lot more about this in the weeks and months to come, Bob.
Indeed, Jim, and that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Peruvians mark their 200th anniversary of independence and mark a new president. And a judgment is expected in the trial of deposed Myanmar leader Aung San Suu Kyi.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Anna Shortridge, Leila Marhamati, and Michael Kohler for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.